So I'm going to just introduce the panel really quickly. On my far left is David Lewis from Binghamton. After September 11th, he enlisted in the Army Reserve. He still is in the Army Reserve. He was 26 when he arrived in Iraq, and he was in the 140th Quartermaster Company of the 4th Infantry Division, and he was assigned at Tikrit. To my immediate left is Perry O'Brien from Peaks Island, Maine. He enlisted 2 weeks prior to 9/11. He was in the 82nd Airborne Division Army. He was assigned Kandahar, Afghanistan. And after the third of his four-year enlistment, he applied for CO status, conscientious objector status, and he received that. And now he's a Cornell student in politics and peace studies. And he co-founded a website called peace-out.com, which to help other people in the military to apply for conscientious objector status. And to my right is Mon Cochran. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps in Vietnam, and he's a professor in human development at Cornell. Who would like to begin? Mon will start.
I don't know how to do this. I hadn't seen the movie before. And so it brings back a lot of memories. And I guess the first thing that I would say that struck me reflects the way I'm feeling right now, and that is that nobody cried. Nobody who testified cried either before or afterwards, as far as I could make out, at least not included in the final cut. It's taken me 25 years to get to the point where I could cry over the experience that I had. And it was getting to that point that helped me realize that I was terrified the whole time I was over there. And I say that because I think that's reflected in what we just saw. I mean, I think you saw a lot of very, very terrified people who were terrified for a lot of different reasons, but became people they didn't recognize in themselves, partly because of that fear. And for me, that carries over to the whole question of who's human and who isn't. And as I listened to testimony about not seeing the Vietnamese as human beings, I was reminded of leaving Long Beach on a carrier. I was over very early in that war. I went over with the first Marine helicopter group that went to Vietnam in August of 1965. In fact, I left Long Beach on my birthday in August of 1965 with 2,000 other Marines, most of whom were officers because they were all pilots. They were helicopter pilots. And when we got a couple of days out of Long Beach, I was in intelligence. I was an intelligence officer, and I was at that point, let's see, this was August, so I had been out of college for a year at that point. I did my undergraduate work at Harvard. So as intelligence officer, of course, I was more than mildly curious about where we were going. And was informed by the naval intelligence, the head of the naval intelligence on the boat, that in fact, when I asked for maps so I could begin to get some sense of where we were going, I was told that we didn't have any maps. That is, we were going to a country for which we had no maps. And so, over the next 2 weeks as we traveled west, maps were made, and by the time we landed, we had maps. But I think you get my point. We didn't know where the hell we were going or why. The second or third day out, there was an announcement over the loudspeaker that's to the effect that anybody who wanted to learn Vietnamese should meet under lifeboat 6 on the starboard side or something like that. There were 2,000 of us on the boat, and I was the only one who showed up. And so I had individual personal Vietnamese lessons for the next 2 weeks, which proved invaluable. But, of course, to learn somebody's language is to suggest that they might be human. And I think perhaps, in my brain, as opposed to my gut and my soul, maybe seeing this film was the first time that I was introduced to the possibility that the military really didn't want us to learn Vietnamese. That is, there was nobody around. Nobody noticed that I was the only one that turned up. Let's just put it that way. So there we were, and of course we got over there, and we were supporting the South Vietnamese with our helicopters, and lo and behold, they didn't speak English. And it turned out that I was needed because I could speak some Vietnamese, one Vietnamese I'd learned in 3 weeks. So this issue of whether people are human or not really resonates with me. And I look forward to hearing from you guys, because and what I'm seeing is the same story in Iraq. I mean, how much time have we spent really trying to understand Iraqi culture, let alone learn languages and all of the things that suggest that, in fact, people might be human beings. The media, I got very pissed off in that movie. Not for the first time. I've been pissed off for 35 years. But I just don't know what to say about the media. They got their own agenda, as we all know. It's become much more obvious since Vietnam. So I think we now begin to take that for granted. I was so struck, you know, as a naive 23-year-old when I returned to the United States after 14 months, to read in the New York Times, you know, the paragon of truth, right? Of military operations that I'd been in, which I read in the paper and could not recognize. There was absolutely no relationship between what the New York Times was writing about an operation that I had just been in. No relationship between that and the experience that I'd had. And I literally, you know, shook my head, like, you know, was I there? Which I think leads to me to another point, which has to do with compartmentalization. What I saw in the guys that were testifying was this incredible capacity, this desperate capacity to compartmentalize, to have these places in the brain and to store the scary shit and to store the bad stuff, to store the atrocities, and then over here to live this other life. And so many of us came out of that experience so compartmentalized. I can speak personally by saying it's taken me 25 years to break down those compartments. And in those 25 years, I have not been the kind of person I could have been because of what I was unable to do, the ways that I was unable to feel, the connection that I was unable to make, all of those kinds of things. And that's called survival. You do that to survive, and that's what those guys were saying. They were saying, we don't know now who we were then, but we knew then that that was who we were supposed to be, who we were trained to be, and it's who we were, and now we're somebody else. And that's big-time compartmentalizing, and it's scary shit. Racism, clearly, this is sort of the global dimensions of racism as we, I think, manifest that, we the United States. I guess when that topic came up, I thought it was very powerful and very telling. paradoxically, and again, I was over there early, what I remember on the racism issue was how in that context over there, my unit cut through traditional American racism. So I remember incidents where guys from the South were blatantly treating African Americans, completely inappropriately. I mean, just ripping them off right, left, and center. And what struck me was how, when we intervened, and we meaning others in the unit, intervened into that behavior, and actually in one case, one of these guys who was taunting this black man, black guy actually pulled his .45 out and blew a hole in his leg, and it felt right. I mean, it felt right in the sense that gross injustice was being done, and it was being done repeatedly, and finally it had to stop. And the unit rallied around that young African American, protected him, and made sure that there was no retribution. And the guy who had been shot was hustled off and patched up and back in the unit, 2 weeks later, and we pressed on. So in that is an interesting kind of twist, sort of inside a particular unit. There was a kind of code of fairness that played itself out, while in the larger context, racism was happening all around us. I mean, racism hardly captures what we were to the Vietnamese. And so that's a powerful dimension. I guess I'd end by just talking about continuity. I mean, when that Native American testified about the day when the grass won't grow and the rivers won't flow, and he made the analogy to Indian massacres, I think he's absolutely onto something. One of the things that I try to do with my students here at Cornell is to help them look back into our history and really understand what our belief systems have been historically since Europeans came to this continent, and track that forward, because I think it helps to legitimize the kind of behavior that those guys described. I think that history and the television and the cowboys and the Indians and all of that stuff serves as a kind of thread that runs through all this, and that it, in some historical way, legitimizes the kind of behavior that we certainly saw in the Vietnam War, and at least Abu Ghraib would suggest we've seen since. Thanks.
That was Mon Cochran, Vietnam veteran. Next is Perry O'Brien, a veteran of the Afghan War.
The two things that occurred to me watching the film. First was an immediate recognition of and a familiarity with the institutionalization of dehumanization of the enemy. On the film, it was, then it was Gook and Charlie, now it's Haji and Towelhead. And that's institutionalized. We had a duty in Kandahar where we were basically we had to go out and guard the Pakistani truck drivers who were making deliveries. And during the sort of shuffling around of cargo and paperwork, they were just sort of sitting there. And somebody had to guard them. That the official name for that duty was Haji Guard. I mean, this was on military memorandums. It was a derogatory term. and it's very purposeful at the high levels. I mean, I think for a lot of the grunts, it's just sort of a cultural thing, but it's very purposeful. They know, and they knew from studies that were done after World War II and that, things that were implemented in Vietnam, is that people are much more likely to shoot when you sort of create a cartoon image of the people living in whatever country you're occupying. So that, I mean, it was very purposeful. And when I disagreed with it, I mean, I just met with, in Afghanistan, absolute widespread, from the officers down, look, this is the way it is. And there are, in Afghanistan, there are these sort of token remarks and not being like outright offensive, especially in front of the media. But in general, I mean, absolutely, they encouraged no cultural awareness whatsoever about, you know, why we're there. There was no attempt to give any sort of language training, even though as medics we had to constantly interact with the Afghani people. I mean, these were where I was working too. I mean, we had patients that we kept for over a month, and the only people that could speak with them were the translators, and a lot of the time they weren't in the clinic. But there was no training done on the type of culture that we were, you know, going to. There was no training done on the indigenous people, no training on language. So that was definitely something that I recognized. I'm sure David will know exactly what I'm talking about. The other thing that really sort of occurred to me that highlighted for me something I had already been thinking about watching the movie, which is the dire importance of making sure that returning veterans are able to tell their stories and that people are actually going to be listening to them. Because I think the Bush administration is terrified of that. I think it's the biggest liability to their incredibly deceitful foreign policy doctrine is veterans, much more so than any other anti-war activist. Even the average veteran is far more deadly to their policies, simply because veterans, you know, when they tell of the horrors that both they're experiencing and that they're, you know, that a lot of times they're being ordered to perpetrate on other people. I mean, it makes American people cringe, you know. And I've come to the belief that, you know, a large part of the sort of yellow flag or yellow ribbon support our troops thing is really more of like a shut up, you're a hero, we don't really want to hear from you once you get back. I think it's absolutely in the interests of most Republicans and a startling majority of Americans to simply not deal with veterans once they get back, to give them a parade and then say, go out and join the workforce, congratulations. I think we just don't want to hear. I think people that support the administration know intuitively the challenge that veteran stories presents. And I think for the rest of, not, I don't want to say us, but for a lot of Americans, they simply don't want to deal with the guilt for a war that they at least initially supported. They don't want to know that young American people and, you know, untold Iraqis suffered these horrible things as a result of basically our desire for revenge following 9/11 and our sort of short-sighted support of really irresponsible foreign policy. So one of the things I'd certainly like to discuss and think about, and I've been talking to a number of people about this, is the best way that specifically people that are in the peace movement can sort of connect with soldiers and make sure that these stories are getting told. And I mean, clearly it would be totally unethical to try and put any sort of pressure on soldiers and say, tell us your story. But and for a lot of veterans, they're just not going to be able to do that for years, even decades. But for those that do want to tell their stories and do have a desire, that, you know, both as a form of catharsis and just as a really important, truth-telling, I think it's really important that we create a medium for that and that there's someone there to listen that's actually going to be able to just listen and not try and characterize it either way and not feel threatened by it. One of the things that I gave a speech about this the other night at Orange Friday, and afterwards I was approached by someone that informed me about a website called mysoldier.com, which basically allows you to become a pen pal with a soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's something I think I really want to start encouraging people in the anti-war movement to start doing, it to, you know, developing a relationship with soldiers that are currently there and sending them packages and hearing it, you know, because I think when soldiers return from war, you know, I mean, the classic line is no soldier returns from war unwounded, and there's an incredible rift, I think, that gets created between returning combat veterans and the rest of society, both to support our troops, you know, and bring them home, and to support our troops and support Bush and support the war people. And I think it's sort of the responsibility of what I view as the much more conscientious, compassionate side of America to take up the burden of, you know, taking on these stories and listening to people. So that's something I'd really like to hear if people have any thoughts or ideas about how we could do that.
Harry O'Brien. Next, David Lewis, Iraq war veteran of Binghamton.
I just want to say that I feel very lucky compared to the men that spoke in the film, because each one of them experienced some kind of, they're responsible for a lot of death. And, I mean, out of their own hands. And that's very difficult to live with. But in my case, I mean, I was never in combat. I mean, I actually never fired my weapon at anyone. But I carry the burden of supporting that and the actions of the people that did. There are legions of soldiers in Iraq right now, probably that outnumber the combat soldiers that spend half their day either doing nothing or playing PlayStation or things like this. And it's... I mean, it was getting to the point there where I mean, everybody had a TV or something like that, you know, satellite dishes and everything. I'm really starting to wonder. Well, no, I'm not starting to wonder. I'm sorry. I've always have wondered why we were there. But it seems to me like it's getting even the stories I hear coming out of other soldiers in my unit that was deployed in the year after me. There was a guy who was a specialist like me who had his own SUV, you know, for no reason. And it's just, it's mind-boggling what a waste this war is in terms of money, but in life. And touching on the subject that Perry was talking about, with no even attempt to learn the culture of the people that are there, we had a PX on our post. It's a post exchange. It's like a little Walmart, basically. And we were in Iraq, and you know, I yearned to learn Arabic the whole time I was there. I never did. But I had the opportunity to learn Farsi if I wanted to buy the language pack they had at the store, and I thought that was pretty funny because, you know, they don't speak Farsi in Iraq, they speak it in Iran, and I thought that was pretty interesting that we could buy those in Iraq, you know, and it was that kind of insensitivity that sort of spreads across the board. Haji was a word, towel head. I mean, this is all. It was even my own commander used the word. And actually, the truth is, Haji is a term of endearment. It means, you know, someone that's gone on the Hajj. You know, they've gone on their pilgrimage to Mecca. And it's supposed to be a good thing, but it's being used sort of against them in a way. And I think that's awful in so many ways beyond what I can even imagine. But that leads me to another subject. It's using someone's convictions against them. It's something I'm having to deal with now. I have only recently started being involved against the war because I'm still in the military. In fact, I had drill this weekend. It's difficult to make my face known because I face a risk, but I decided that it's, I think, far riskier if I don't say anything, and if I don't somehow do my part to stop it, because there's each and every death is a personal tragedy for everyone around that person that's ever lived with them and will live without them. And there are people walking around today and that tomorrow will be gone. And if the war had ended last week, it wouldn't be like that. And I don't know, I can't live with myself knowing that I just let it happen. So I've decided to try to get a conscientious objector discharge, and I'm in the process now. I haven't submitted the paperwork, but I'm actually in trouble because I've been pictured in a protest, and my unit had an investigative officer sent to my unit this weekend, so I might be facing some discipline because of it, and it's. I was photographed at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. I made the mistake of wearing my uniform top, and So I might have violated a specific code in the Army regulations. So if I do get disciplined, there's very little they can do anyway. But I'm gonna wear like a badge of honor, I think. And hopefully then, you know, I don't know, maybe put a feather in my cap and move on. But I think I'm making it my goal, basically, to educate people about the human cost in terms of how it affects us when we get back. And everyone, I think... He said that no soldier comes back unwounded, and I think that's absolutely true. I've had my moments. I still have them. And I just hope that no one else, you know, that's wondering, should I join the military? Is this a good time to do that? I just want them to know that it now is not probably not the time if they want to keep their sanity, because the whole country is sort of in a turmoil right now. There, half of us want the war to stop, and the other half just haven't come to that conclusion yet. That's how I feel. And anyway, I'm going to ramble if I keep going, so I'll pass the mic over to Brian here.
So anyway, let's entertain questions.
But given that ostensibly we were fighting for the South Vietnamese, ostensibly we're fighting for the Iraqis to help them, you know, be Saddam instead of democracy. And that, you know, hearing the way you just slaughtered all Vietnamese at the end of December, and there was no interest except from you in learning the language of these people that supposedly were helping.
Well, I think what happened was that fear kicked in. And that when fear kicks in, you stop discriminating. And so that all you need to do is to be shot at a few times from a village. And you're terrified. And you respond. And all of a sudden, these political distinctions that you're offering, that's not, you're not operating up in the prefrontal lobe at that point. You're operating down in here, and because we're totally uneducated about the people that we were in whose country we were occupying, then the intellectual stuff went away fast. I mean, there was no knowledge structure operating, and so very quickly you went to your gut and your instinct, and you responded instinctively, and of course that's the way we're trained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You're trained. You're trained to respond instinctively, and so this notion of, gee, was that a Viet Cong or is that just a, you know, a grandfather? Okay, I mean, that's a subtle distinction at that point. Okay, and that's the reality of war. And so if we're going to fight wars, we've got to acknowledge that reality up front. Understand that that's what we're going over there to do. I mean, we can have intellectual discussions about how we want to shift the balance of power in the Middle East. That's bullshit when you get in there. That's horseshit. I'm using the language of the people here. You know, that's crap. You're in there and you're protecting your ass. Okay, and it does turn into a game. It can easily turn into a game because that's the life you build for yourself.
Yes.
I'm pulling it down from this sort of intellectual to what's going on the ground.
Yeah, something that I noticed in training is that all other government organizations like the police or SWAT team or anything like that, you know, FBI, when they do their firearms training, any other federal group that's armed that is going to potentially be in a civilian population, they go through firearms training where you have to distinguish between civilian and hostile. You know, everyone's seen this in like Die Hard or some cop movie, you know, like the guy with the gun pointing at you pops up and you shoot him, and then like the little cardboard thing with the mother holding the baby pops up and you don't shoot that. We don't have that in the military. We have white human-shaped silhouettes and you shoot all of them. Mm-hmm. And the way that, and I'm sure you guys can, you know, talk about this and confirm this, but the way you learn to shoot is you're looking over this, you know, broad field at the range. It's like 300 meters long and really wide, and you just have to sort of use your peripheral vision. And as soon as something moves, you turn and shoot it. There's not enough time to do well on that sort of, on that marksmanship course to turn, identify a target, and then shoot it. So you get trained to shoot at movement. And I don't know if that's purposeful, but it certainly, I think, probably contributes to a loss of civilian life because our infantry, they're not trained to distinguish between civilian and enemy targets. They're just trained to shoot at movement.
And you layer that on top of the fact that nobody talks to us about these folks as people, as having a culture, as having a language, as having traditions, as having families, as any of that. None of that happens. It's And you know, I think we could argue it's antithetical. It's antithetical to the killing machine. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say one thing. For those who aren't familiar with how the My Lai story came out, and from what we heard on the testimony of a lot of the people, there certainly was a lot of human rights abuses going on. You know, I mean, Scott Campbell killed many, many, many people for little or no reason. But My Lai came to into existence because of a couple heroic individuals. And you know, it's really difficult to be heroic in those situations. But one was a helicopter pilot that saw all these women and children being shot in My Lai and landed his helicopter and started loading a lot of the injured people. And he had to held a gun on the platoon that was shooting. It had been going on for 4 hours, and he stopped it. And the other thing was someone that was in another unit but had heard stories, like hundreds of people in Vietnam knew My Lai had happened, and where 400 to 500 of the 700 that lived in the village were killed in 4 hours. So this person went and he talked to all the people and just as collecting information, and he gathered it all up and he sent it to a bunch of congressional committees, sent it to the media, and therefore the story came to be known, and it widely was reported. But there were hundreds of incidents that were worth reporting, but because of the culture, it's very, very difficult to be a hero.
I think the film really made clear these atrocities are not aberrations. This is exactly the purpose of the thing. I don't know, what can people do to confront the truth that this is the purpose of the military, to commit atrocities and torture and war crimes, and the only way that it will stop is to abolish the military?
When I joined the military because I thought that I was going to be fighting for peace. And I know that sounds like a contradiction, and it is a contradiction, because that's not possible. And I thought that, you know, every country, has legitimate defense needs and requires a military to, you know, to keep its borders from its enemies. And once again, that's why I thought it was okay to join the military. I thought I had to rationalize it, actually, because I mean, I'm not a violent person, and I don't really believe in killing. But I suppressed those feelings because I thought that, well, we were attacked, and there has to be a response, and you know, they were in the process of getting the guy that was responsible, and I just don't feel like that anymore personally. I don't know how to put it, but I found that the contradiction is too much. With the military the size that we have, that like it just begs for war. It wants to keep having them, and that's why I want to get out. But I'll move on to the next.
Yeah, I was just going to say that when a lot of the Abu Ghraib and other sort of human rights abuses scandal broke, what you heard a lot from sort of the hard line right-wing hawks was, well, you know what? You know, people shouldn't be so surprised. This is what happens in war. And they're absolutely right. But the conclusion that we should draw from that is not that, oh, well, it's okay for these things to happen. It's that we probably shouldn't be using war as casually as we do, because it's absolutely true that these things happen in every single war. I think one of the tragic consequences of the first Gulf War is we sort of created this myth of, like, a clean war, which, I mean, totally not true. I mean, it actually, the first Gulf War for Americans actually had the highest casualty ratio, if you look at combat-induced injuries over the next decade, of any war, including World War II. I mean, it was not a clean war. I mean, we using things like depleted uranium, we fought a low-yield nuclear war in Iraq. But anyway, there was this image of, like, well, thanks to this sort of institutionalization of high-tech war, we can now fight wars clean. Wars aren't clean. They always involve torture. They always involve cruelty, and they always involve just dehumanization on both sides. And I think I'd like to see people take that more into account when policy decisions are made.
I was so struck in the film by the discussion of the Geneva Convention, because it was the first time that it occurred to me that in my Marine Corps training and while I was in Vietnam, nobody ever talked to me about how I was supposed to treat other people. It was all about how they were supposed to treat me. And that is, in fact, extraordinary. But part of the plan. In a broad, I don't mean to be too paranoid about this, but part of the picture. That is, we're humans and they're not, and so they should treat us like humans, and we don't have to treat them that way. It seems to me, in response to your question or your thought, that we need to do better with this war than we did with my war, in the sense that we make much more transparent the devastation. That is, it seems to me that the only way that we can speak to future wars is by documenting the present and documenting the consequences. I mean, we've got thousands and thousands of men and women coming back to the United States who are disappearing. Now, how much time are we spending with the wounded and the maimed and the psychologically screwed up who are coming back from that war? I mean, how much debriefing, how much psychological debriefing did you get when you came home? I got jack shit, to put it bluntly. Nobody talked to me about how I was feeling.
Yeah, something that we've been hearing is that when you're in Iraq, and I don't know, maybe you can talk about this, but it's common knowledge that if you complain of PTSD, you not only do you not get sent home early, you might not leave when your unit leaves because they want to make sure you're okay before you return home. So admitting that you're having psychological problems can actually prevent you from going home after a year-long deployment.
And the concept of being okay, this concept of being okay.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
I mean, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, especially because PTSD often doesn't strike until
right.
years
for years.
Later.
Yeah. So how do we do that? How do we make visible the consequences? I mean, it's terribly hard to make visible the consequences in Iraq. We practically have to make up the numbers in order to get numbers that even begin to represent the dead and wounded and devastated Iraqi people. But at least we ought to be documenting what the hell's going on in our own country, because it's going to be with us for the next 40 years. Trust me.
A thought that I had, too, is that it's very important. I mean, David is here as an active Army reservist. You know, that we, and Perry, although he's out, I mean, he's speaking, and therefore he's a prime target for a lot of people that are sowing disinformation. And you don't have to know that these testimonies from almost 35 years ago are still resonating in our society. And we saw it with the last presidential election, with the Swift Boat veterans dragging up a John Kerry's association with this testimony. So, and there's plenty of websites out there that are continuing. They're attacking the reissuing of the movie. There's a website, wintersoldier.com, that's a FREEP site, you know, the conservative group site. So there's still a lot of interest in conservative communities in debunking the information that was brought out in that film.
Do you have any idea about how many people have returned from service from the war? And then I'd like a discussion about what you think we might do to reach out to these people.
I heard that, I read somewhere that, and this was several months ago, that 600,000 U.S. service members have been there already, and probably add to that a couple hundred more thousand within the next year, probably. So that's a lot of people, and I'm even still in the military, and there's been really nothing to reach out to us in terms of, for instance, we're given 6 months of 2 years of Veterans Administration care, but see, I was in the first rotation of troops, and I was the first to come back, and I was, you know, when I was there, I went to the induction seminar to tell you all about stuff, but I was there with the old-timers that, you know, basically have waited until, you know, 50 years later to go check out something that they might have gotten in the war that they were in. And they didn't know what to do with us yet at the time because we were just brand new. I mean, I was 27, I think, or 26. I wanted my foot injury that I got in Iraq to be documented, but because my medical records were in transit somewhere, I don't even know where they were, and I couldn't give the VA the record that I had been treated for something, because I had this injury treated by a 4th Infantry Division medical team of some kind. All the record that has to do with that treatment, which actually was almost nothing anyway, was somewhere either in Fort Hood or out of a shredder. I don't know what happened to it, but the VA wants that before they can help me. So I don't know what I'm supposed to do in that 2-year time. Like, what am I supposed to do? Nothing. There's really been no real help for us. They give us 6 months of regular active duty style medical insurance, but basically you just go to a doctor and say, "Yeah, I feel okay." Okay, great. That's your appointment. That's it.
It's bad standard of care. I know, as a medic.
So yeah, I, as a veteran that was in this recent conflict, I can tell you very little.
I just want to make a very brief parallel without going into detail. I mean, since the early 80s, I have worked in federal and state prisons. As I mentioned, I still do run a program for people coming home in New York City. And there are such deep parallels to what is called the prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex. And just as no one comes home, from a war unwounded, I mean, people come home from prison every day. Over 2 million are incarcerated with $40 in their pocket and good luck. I think when addressing military issues, we have to also look at what institutions and what's going on within this nation, in other areas that are really the same questions, really the same issues. Permeates this culture very deeply.
Hey, just wanted to thank you guys for coming very much. I'm not a very good speaker, so I'll ask you very quick. What was your reaction during the Pat Tillman fiasco and the Jessica Lynch lies?
You were wondering what happens to them when they come back. Scott Camille is a personal friend. I know him from Florida. And the last time I was there a couple of years ago, he still wasn't sleeping at night. He still goes to bed. He can't sleep in the dark. As soon as it gets dark, that's when everything is, dangerous. And he goes to sleep in the morning. His wife is a saint. She's wonderful. And he also was very active, as you know. When he came back speaking and organizing Gainesville Veterans Against the War and Vietnam Veterans Against the War and speaking in around the country, and he was basically a top on a list, I guess, somewhere. So one evening, a car came up with two FBI or people in it and came to, they wanted to talk to him to come and get in the car, that people want to talk to him. And as he said, you don't get in a car with people you don't know. And so he thought, well, what'll I do? He went to the door and he saw the neighbors were looking. So, okay, they're, threatening me. I've got to get in that car. So he gets in the car and notices they lock the, lock things the driver, I guess, didn't know where he should go next, because he said something about it. He was asking the man sitting next to him a question, and the man next to him looked over the seat, like at a map or something, and at that moment, Scott said, "It's now or never," and he opens the door to get out, and he had a bullet in his back, and he lost a kidney. And that's after two tours of duty and being a patriot. And that's my, after that, when I heard that, I just don't believe anything the government tells me.
Having, for some of you who spoke, having at one time believed that this was a just thing to get involved with, and then having since changed your beliefs, I'm wondering if you have any insights about how to help people who don't want to see this, don't want to know about it, don't want to hear about it, or are doing that compartmentalizing, how to help to penetrate that.
Well, that's where I think making it much more visible. I think it has to be made human. I think it has to be one-on-one feeling. feeling level kinds of work. And so, I mean, in every one of our communities, there must be. I mean, if 600,000 people have rotated through Iraq, then these folks are not far away. Some of you may be right in this room. I don't know. But certainly if you're not in this room, you're not far away. But do we know you? And so to the extent that there can begin to be community activity around who's been where and why and how they're feeling and how it's going and all of that, to that extent, it seems to me very difficult to stay in those compartments. And that forces you out. And we need to find ways to provide those opportunities.
Yeah, an idea that I've come up with recently, and I haven't really been talking about this much because it's still at a very conceptual stage, but one idea to sort of address that problem. My fiance does work in, or does a lot of work in theater for social change and community theater and things like that, and we are in the process of coming up with, well, first collecting stories and doing grant writing to come up with a script for a performance piece that we'd start getting actors for here in Ithaca and trying to do it in Tompkins County that would basically tell soldier stories and tell the other side of the realities of military service that young people and parents and everyone is not getting from the media, is not getting from recruitment. So I'd love to hear feedback on this because it's going to become my own personal pet project if people have any ideas on it. Are interested in becoming involved down the line. But I just think that's theater is such a powerful way of emotionally connecting people. And I'd love to use actual soldiers' words, actual stories on not just, you know, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the recruitment lies, the sexual harassment that goes on in the military, the hazing, the poor treatment of veterans, you know, by the administration, by the bureaucracy, not by the anti-war movement when they return. The sort of disappearing act that happens when veterans come back, the inability of veterans, of combat veterans, to sort of reconnect with their family members, and the suicide problems. I'd really like to find some way to bring those to a diverse number of audiences. That's one idea I've come up with for a way to do that. But if people have other suggestions, it's something I think it is the key issue of this challenge posed by us right now. But I absolutely agree. Like, these stories need to get out. And they're not. And the media has no interest in covering them. I mean, every once in a while.
Forget the media.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're...
That's not the way to do it. Yeah. Forget the media. I mean, we got to do it community by community. And the churches have got to get involved. Schools have got to get involved. Yeah, we've got to work with our basic community-level institutions.
I completely agree. Yeah, I would love to see people in Ithaca working on a model for some way of communicating these stories, be it theater or some other way that could be replicated and that could be used in other communities across the country, because it's not being done at all. And these stories, I mean, they're fading away, and people are, I mean, Iraq veterans are already popping up all over all over the country in homeless shelters because they're not able to adjust. And I mean, did you want to say something?
Well, yeah, I wanted to say one thing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'd
like to see an end to the brand naming of supposed enemies of the United States, because this is what dehumanizes it makes it able for the average American to just say, you know, these are the people we need to destroy. And I think that some people just want to have their own way other than ours, and maybe don't speak our language or don't want to do business with us for certain reasons, but the way that our country is set up now, that's not acceptable to us, and they become the enemy all of a sudden. And I think that if there's a way to change that, then, and I don't know how to do that, but that's something I would like to see. There be less enemies in the world to fight. I think that will take away the momentum of the military and the hawks to be able to rally the people to fight these supposed enemies. I'd love to know how to do that.
One of the things that is an important thing to me is to try to speak to my brothers, two of whom were in Vietnam, and they don't want to hear about it. They don't want to talk to me. And so what I want to know from you three is, are you told not to talk when you come home?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not in my day.
No, they told us basically not to talk to the press or to limit our words to things like, you know, support the troops, that kind of stuff. Like, you know, we need help over there. You know, we're glad you're home helping us, that kind of stuff. You know, and that's the limit.
Yeah, I don't think my unit would have dared tell me not to talk because they know I would have told someone that they told me not to talk based on my behavior before that. But I think that there is a – I think that's certainly an undertone to a lot of the advice that people get given. I mean, there's a whole department of – at least in the Army, there's a whole public affairs. They decide what does and doesn't get said to the media. And they can limit what you put in letters that you send home, all kinds. I mean, they basically act as the military censors. And once you get discharged, there's really not much legal ground for it. But there's certainly a cultural understanding that that you're sort of a traitor if afterwards you – betray that. And I mean, I think for a lot of people, they're not willing to deal with it, not for any necessarily political reasons, but just reasons of psychological survival. Yeah, they right. just can't. I mean, there are still Vietnam vets, you know, parents or friends that I have who just won't talk about their experience.
So there are two kinds of talking.
Yeah.
There are two kinds of talking. There's the public talk, which is what you're referring to in the military addresses. And then there's the private talk, which I think you were referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're not resisting that for political reasons or because of any cultural anything. It's all about how hard it is. It's all about those compartments. It's all about the safety that comes from pushing it over into that room, locking the door, bolting it 10 times, and protecting yourself. I mean, for them to open themselves up, to become vulnerable, is incredibly risky psychologically.
Yeah.
But you know, at least in my case, after 25 years, the compartments began to break down. Not of my own volition. I mean, they just began to break down. And at that point, it was really important to have people around me who could say, "Are you okay?" And to whom I could turn and say, "I'm not okay." And I finally realized that I'm not okay. It's really critical. So keep reaching out.
Yeah, and just because though your brothers may just not be in a place where they can talk, it doesn't mean that it wouldn't be helpful to make yourself available to other veterans potentially. I mean, I think...
That's true.
I think, I mean, I'm not a psychological expert at all, but I suspect that the longer you wait, the more difficult it is to open those floodgates. And for soldiers that are returning, I think there's such a deficiency of people that are willing to listen, because I guarantee there are so many soldiers who are coming back and their parents aren't even listening, you know, and they can't, and not even necessarily because their parents may not, you know, if a parent, you know, encourages their child to join the military, and then the parent is not going to be willing to listen to the horrors that they experience as a result, and you know, the feelings they have. There's a documentary called The Ground Truth that talks a lot about wounded soldiers, and one soldier that killed himself after coming back from Iraq. The last thing he did was throw his dog tags at his sister and say, "Don't you understand? Your brother's a murderer."
My father, I just had this discussion with him. I was in the Citizens Tribunal against the Iraq War that Teresa during her trial, and I was on the news the same night, and my father saw the news and called me and left a very angry message on my machine, on my cell phone, telling me that I was disappointed in me, because he's one of these parents that said, "Well, you know, you should join the military." And eventually I did, and he still believes in the war and still believes in all of this stuff. And there's no way that I'm going to change his mind. And at least that's not something I hope for, but I mean, that's, I think, the reality. Sometimes they won't understand, because they have a 180 degree, you know, difference of opinion, and it's unfortunately the way that political climate is now, that, you know, you can't be in the middle anymore. You know, it's not really possible because of what's going on. You know, each side is forcing each other to the opposite, and I'm trying to get my dad on my side, but we'll see. You know.
I don't know about the other people on the panel here, but I've done a lot of work as a counter-recruiter, and I'm, for educators and people that know teachers, I'm more than happy to go into school, high school classrooms and talk to young people. The way to get people in is to not say, I have a counter-recruiter that wants to talk. You say, I have a recently returned veteran who wants to provide some historic or educational, cultural background to the experience. There are a lot of schools in this county whose the thing is principals have sort of a political position, and they usually spout this, well, we need a balanced perspective thing, which means we basically need to find a really right-wing, recently returned vet to balance out the perspective of someone like a conscientious objector. They don't, however, feel the need to provide a balance when they give recruiters almost, you know, total access to the schools. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is any kid that's ever talked to a recruiter has been lied to. And until they actually talk to a veteran, you know, then they're not going to understand the scope of those lies and the mistake. And the fact of the matter is, even a lot of people who come from sort of a strong military background don't, you know, a lot of older people don't understand what the military is like today, and that, you know, those discrepancies are much. I think I don't know. I mean, I was in the military before, but I think the lies have gotten even worse. When you see the ridiculous extremes that recruiters are going to reach out to, you know, young blacks with, you know, and they have these Hummers now with rims on them and everything, and, you know, hip hop army, it's so cool, and they have a video game, as I'm sure people are aware, that, I mean, come on, what worst possible analogy could you make with military service than a video game where you go around killing, you know, pixels? They're just going to, as far as I know, unprecedented extremes to try and rope people in. They're still not meeting quotas. And I think counter-recruitment is another really essential thing to stopping the war. I mean, if we don't have enough people, their choices are draft or no war. And I don't want to see a draft, but, I think we need to force their hand. That's my personal belief.
Okay. Well, I'd like to bring this to a conclusion now and... I found it a very moving experience to hear people share their stories, and hope that we can continue to do that throughout the rest of this week. So thank you very much for coming.
You've been listening to a panel of local veterans, David Lewis, Perry O'Brien, and Mon Cochran, speaking following the screening of Winter Soldier in Ithaca earlier this month. Thanks to Mike Pitzrick of Birdhouse Friends, Mary Fessenden of Cornell Cinema, Carl Fitzke, and Malarium Films, WinterSoldierFilm.com, for making this week's program possible. You can download an MP3 of this and previous shows at our website, unwelcomeguests.org.
Won't you please? Will you please forgive me for my sins?